Today is Monday, August 9th, and you're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Taliban seizes government buildings in Kunduz.
The Taliban offensive across Afghanistan has now seen the group seize control of several key official buildings in the city of Kunduz.
Plus, U.S. health officials raise alarm over a surge of COVID Delta variant.
Overall cases are at a six-month high, and according to the White House, Florida is among seven states accounting for half of all new cases.
Also, Ukraine's president to visit Washington despite growing Russia ties. Our top story today is in Afghanistan. Taliban fighters have seized key government buildings in the northeastern Afghan city of Kunduz, leaving government forces hanging onto control of the airport and their own base, a provincial assembly lawmaker said on Sunday. Matthew Laratonda of Reuters reports.
Alhamdulillah, that was the sea.
The Taliban offensive across Afghanistan has now seen the group seize control of several key official buildings in the city of Kunduz, leaving only the city's airport and a military base in control of the government. That's according to a local politician. This video, released by the Taliban, is said to show its fighters walking through the police headquarters there. The politician told Reuters that militants have also taken control of government buildings in another city, the capital of Saripol province. Similar reports are coming from at least two other cities as well. The news comes only a day after the funeral of a senior spokesperson for President Ashraf Ghani's government, who was assassinated by the Taliban. In recent days, the Taliban have taken a third city, Zaranj, the first provincial capital seized by the group in years, and there are hundreds of people stuck on the border with Pakistan, which was closed after the Taliban took control of a crossing there last month. Afghan security forces report heavy fighting in Kunduz, a strategic location and home to 270,000 people. The Taliban's advance has gained momentum as American and allied forces withdraw from the country.
The Taliban continued their military offensives around the weekend, reportedly overrunning three provincial capitals by Sunday evening. This after they captured Zaranj on Friday and detonated bombs in the country's capital. For an update on the fighting, International Edition Steve Miller spoke with VOA Afghan and Pakistan Bureau Chief Ayesha Tanzim.
We know that there are three cities in the north and northeastern Afghanistan that the Taliban forces claim that they overran. The government does not confirm any of the three, although in one, in Kunduz city, the government says it has launched a counter-operation. And even in Saripol, in the Saripol province, it's not confirming that it was overran, but eyewitnesses and local sources told us so. Kunduz is a very significant city. The Taliban have tried to overrun it three times since 2010. And the last two times they were able to get to the center of the city, but were only able to stay there for a couple of days each before government forces attacked and took it back from the Taliban. So just because it was overrun doesn't mean the Taliban can hold it. We will see in the coming days what happens. So what this takeover of the provincial capital, it started Friday with the first provincial capital in Nimroz province, Zaranj, falling to the Taliban. Saturday, a second provincial capital, Shabarghand, fell to the Taliban in Jawzjan. That is also home to former warlord and Afghanistan's highest ranking military officer, Marshal Abdurrashid Dostum. Previously, Taliban were taking over only rural territory, but now they have actually started going after provincial capitals.
Aisha, I wanted to ask you about something that President Ashraf Ghani mentioned last week, and that was that he had a plan, he said, that would turn things around in about 6 months. Do we know anything more about the president's plan to take on the Taliban?
No, it continues to stay vague. He has said that the plan will work in about 6 months. He has said that the plan has already been launched. And like I said, very few details, just that the military will defend strategic targets. The Interior Ministry will be responsible, which the Interior Ministry oversees the police. That will look after the district centers. And the NDS will coordinate with people's militias, what is being called as public uprising killings against the Taliban. And basically, President Ghani has also asked on all parliamentarians to help the defense forces by asking all the people that they influenced, all the people who voted for them, to rise up against the Taliban in the form of public uprising.
Aisha, the fighting is not only taking place in rural areas as well as the provincial capitals now, but also there have been a pair of bombings recently in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. And I was wondering if you could speak to the strategy of why the Taliban is taking the fight there.
Well, there are two things that are happening there. The Afghan forces have the biggest advantage they have is the air force. Wherever the Afghans are using the air force, the Taliban are forced back. So the Taliban are trying to level the playing field by going after the pilot, because the air force is no use without trained pilots, and they have already killed somewhere between 6 to 8 of them. So the Taliban are trying to level the playing field, and they're trying to make the Afghan edge, take away the Afghan edge with the Air Force. And the attack on the defense minister's house, well, first of all, the Taliban know what an attack inside Kabul, especially so close to the green zone, means. It shows the government's weaknesses. It really makes the public jittery and panicky when Taliban can attack inside Kabul. And that's exactly what the Taliban want. They want to show that they can attack anywhere they want. And of course, the Afghan government's response is that defending the entire country, I mean, attacking in suicide attack or guerrilla ambushes is easy because, of course, you have surprise on your side. Defending is more difficult because, as they say, the cliche goes, they have to succeed 100% of the times, whereas the attackers only have to succeed one time.
That's VOA Afghan and Pakistan Bureau Chief Aisha Tanzim speaking with my colleague Steve Miller from Kabul. U.S. health officials say they remain concerned about the spread of the coronavirus Delta variant, despite recent statistics that show 70% of U.S. adults are now partially inoculated against COVID-19, the disease caused by the virus. VOA's Arash Rabasadi has more.
Cars lined up this past week at a federal government testing site in Miami, Florida. The Miami Herald reports that while cases have spiked across all age groups in the state, analysis reveals the biggest jump in children under 12. Overall cases are at a six-month high, and according to the White House, Florida is among 7 states accounting for half of all new cases. Dr. Francis Collins is director of the National Institutes of Health, or NIH. He tells ABC's This Week the latest surge was avoidable.
We would not be in the place we are right now with this Delta surge if we'd been more effective in getting everybody to take advantage of these immunizations, and now we're paying a terrible price.
At a recent news conference, Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis played down the risks.
I think it's important to point out because, you know, obviously media does hysteria. You try to fearmonger. You try to do this stuff. And when they'll talk about hospitalizations, our hospitals are open for business.
Collins on ABC's This Week said vaccination remains the best path forward as the country faces a Delta variant bringing an alarming new trend.
These are younger people now, including children. The largest number of children so far in the whole pandemic right now are in the hospital. 1,450 kids in the hospital from COVID-19. And of course, since they're under 12, many of them, they couldn't be vaccinated. But the rest of us who are over 12 could have done a better job.
And while the country's cases, Florida's in particular, continue climbing, DeSantis pledges to stay the course.
In terms of shutting down, we're not shutting down. We're going to have schools open. We're protecting every Floridian's job in this state. We're protecting people's small businesses. These interventions have failed time and time again throughout this pandemic, not just in the United States, but abroad.
President Joe Biden, here on his way to church, recently announced that federal workers will be required to sign forms confirming their vaccination status or face weekly COVID testing. The administration is expected to soon release guidance on a vaccine mandate for foreign travelers to the United States. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. intelligence community is expected to send a report to President Joe Biden later this month, examining the two leading theories on the origins of COVID-19. One claims the virus was accidentally released from a lab, the other that it emerged from human contact with an infected animal. VOA's Jesus Menoni reports from Washington.
Nearly 18 months into the COVID-19 global pandemic, questions remain over the origins of the virus. The U.S. intelligence community has said it does not know exactly where, when, or how the virus was first transmitted. And just this past June, the top U.S. intelligence official warned intelligence agencies may never find a so-called smoking gun. But the issue has become a potent political topic in Congress. Most Democrats are waiting on the intelligence findings, but Republicans this month released a report advocating another theory on COVID's origins, one already rejected by U.S. intelligence officials, claiming there is paper trail that shows China's Wuhan Institute of Virology was involved with dangerous research, manipulating the virus's genetic code.
We said it was a possibility. Now I believe there's a preponderance of evidence that it did. It was manufactured in the lab and it leaked, most likely accidentally.
Republican Representative Michael McCaul told VOA's Mandarin service the Chinese government is withholding important data on possible early infections in September 2019.
Well, I think the WHO was very ineffective in warning the world about a global pandemic. They've been very ineffective in investigating this. At the end of the day, the answer from top scientists are sitting in the archives of the Wuhan lab itself that the PRC will not release publicly.
Yet while there is frustration with the way China has answered questions about the outbreak, the leading theory among many scientists is that the virus did in fact originate from a natural source. Virologist Dr. Ben Newman, who has studied coronaviruses for 25 years.
It looks a lot like all the other bat viruses that are out there, and there aren't any specific features you could find on this virus that you can't find on several more coronaviruses.
President Joe Biden in May gave the U.S. intelligence community 90 days to provide an in-depth assessment of the coronavirus origins.
The president asked the intelligence community to redouble their efforts to collect and analyze information that could bring us closer to a definitive conclusion.
Beijing has resisted prior international efforts to investigate the virus's origins and in July rejected a bid by the World Health Organization to conduct a second phase of investigations in Wuhan. China also dismissed the lab leak theory as defying science.
In order to shift its responsibility in poor COVID-19 response and out of the political motive of smearing and suppressing others, U.S. has been busy with the politicization, stigmatization, and turning early tracing study into its tool.
Experts say it's critical to find the origin of a virus that has so far killed more than 4 million people worldwide.
It's like finding a leak in the dam and then, you know, you can plug it and then you no longer have the leak, basically. And we do not know where that is or how imminent the danger is, whether this thing is really close or far away, whether there are lots of different variants of this thing or whether it was a one-time thing.
The U.S. intelligence community has said there is no available evidence that the virus was man-made or genetically modified. Jason Samelny, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America. Belarus authoritarian leader on Monday charged that the opposition was plotting a coup in the run-up to last year's presidential election that triggered a month-long wave of mass protests. President Alexander Lukashenko held his annual press conference on Monday, the one-year anniversary of the vote that handed him a sixth term in office, but was denounced by the opposition and the West as rigged. More than 30 Chinese officials have been fired or received other punishments over accusations they failed to respond properly to the latest surge of the coronavirus in the country. Among those fired were a vice mayor, heads of city districts and health commissioners, and staff in hospital management, airport and tourism departments. China's National Health Commission on Monday announced 94 new cases of domestic transmission had been recorded over the previous 24 hours.
This is Science in a Minute.
Last week, after the new Russian module docked with the ISS, NASA reported an unplanned firing of its thrusters. The space agency tweeted this caused the ISS to move 45 degrees out of attitude, adding ground teams stabilized the space station.
NASA later updated its tweet, saying the module's thrusters were still in operation when the 45-degree shift was reported, and that the space station's total attitude change was about 540 degrees out of alignment. That means the ISS flipped over 1.5 times before resuming normal attitude control and operations. In an email to VOA, NASA says the space station's attitude change was slow enough to go unnoticed by ISS crew members, and that all other station systems operated nominally during the entire event. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, said the United States has asked 24 Russian diplomats to leave the country when their visas expire in September. The move comes shortly after the U.S. embassy in Moscow was forced to lay off dozens of Russians working there. Daria Dygots has the story.
U.S. officials say there is no political gamesmanship behind the decision to ask 24 Russian diplomats to leave the U.S. by September 3rd. State Department spokesman Ned Price said it's all part of the visa renewal process Russian diplomats working in the U.S. have to go through every 3 years.
The 3-year limit on visa validity for Russians, it's nothing new. When visas expire, as you might expect, these individuals are expected to leave the country or apply for an extension.
But Russian officials say the U.S. in effect is forcing the Russians out because it has, quote, tightened visa-issuing procedures. The U.S. move comes shortly after Russia barred the U.S. from hiring Russian citizens and third-party citizens to work in the embassy in Moscow. That move forced the U.S. to lay off more than 180 local employees, and that, experts say, put even more pressure on the embassy.
The visa issue is very important, which is to say Russian students, Russians who want to visit the United States and so forth, and it works the same way here, need a visa to come to the United States. And the demands on an embassy are so high, and even a big embassy like Moscow was, that you need extra help. And that means that the U.S. government hires local Russians after a clearance who do very important work, most often helping with visas. In a way, think of it as a step toward better cooperation.
The Kremlin's plan to stop allowing Russian citizens to work at the U.S. embassy was announced in April. All this is part of a long-running, low-level diplomatic battle between Washington and Moscow that's been going on since the Trump administration. The back-and-forth diplomatic battle reached its peak in March 2021 when Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, left the United States to go to Russia for a consultation. Later, the U.S. ambassador in Russia, John Sullivan, was advised to go back to Washington for guidance. Both diplomats are back at their posts, but relations between the two countries remain icy, despite a meeting between U.S. President Biden and Putin in June. Experts believe this only accentuates the difficulty in the bilateral relations.
The Kremlin is pursuing very dangerous policies that contradict our interests. And our most important measures need to be firm in stopping those policies.
Despite the diplomatic back and forth, officials in Moscow and Washington say they are committed to continued engagement on large-scale strategic issues. Daria Dygots for VOA News, Washington.
While Ukraine's president prepares for a visit to Washington, Kyiv is accepting COVID-19 vaccines from China and has signed a major infrastructure agreement with Beijing to cooperate on roads, bridges, and railway projects. Some experts worry China is attaching strings to the ventures, as VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Ukraine's Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba met with U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken this week at the State Department to prepare for a long-awaited visit later this month by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to the White House.
I came here, as Tony Ryan pointed out, to prepare the visit of my president to Washington. We want this visit to be productive, to have many deliverables, which will bring our relations to the next level.
Blinken pledged strong U.S. support for Ukraine in the face of Russian aggression.
The United States is very much committed to friends of independence and sovereignty and territorial integrity. We'll talk about challenges to each of those and the work that we're doing together to stand for a strong Ukraine that can defend itself against external aggression, but also pursue the vitally important process of reform to strengthen even more its democracy and economy.
Last month, China announced it signed an agreement with Ukraine, encouraging companies and financial institutions from the two countries to cooperate on roads, bridges, and railways. Just days before, Ukraine abruptly withdrew its endorsement of a joint statement calling for a United Nations investigation into human rights abuses of Muslim Uyghurs and other minorities in the Xinjiang region of China. VOA's Ukrainian service asked Foreign Minister Kuleba if forging closer ties with China is a departure from Ukraine's integration with the West.
Ніякого розвороту України немає. Ми є частиною західного світу.
This is not a reversal. We are part of the Western world. We are developing as part of this world. But trade with China is an objective reality. And even though the United States is a principal security policy toward China, trade is moving in this own direction. And our relations with China are developing based on this model.
But several experts express concern that Ukraine's rapprochement with China could backfire. Stephen Blank is with the Foreign Policy Research Institute.
It has already created a backlash in certain quarters in the United States. Ukraine depends on Washington much more than it does on Beijing, and Beijing is not going to go out of its way to help Kiev.
Others saw a direct link between Ukraine's reversal on China's repression of ethnic Muslim Uyghurs, which Beijing denies, and the agreements on investment and vaccines. John Herbst of the Atlantic Council.
We saw that in connection with the Ukrainian position on China's genocide against the Uyghurs. What China's doing there is easily the greatest human rights violation happening in the world today. But Ukraine decided, well, maybe it did not need to join a group criticizing China over this in order to maintain profitable business relationship.
Other experts say Ukraine was likely frustrated by the U.S. not doing more to stop Germany from building Russia's controversial Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline, which Kyiv strongly opposes.
The announcement is more in tune with showcasing Ukraine's displeasure with the United States. But again, I think this is a dangerous game if the Ukrainians are playing in this way. I think they need to stand up for human rights abuses everywhere in the world, just as the United States stands up for the abuse of Ukrainian citizens' human rights in occupied regions of eastern Ukraine.
Most experts agree that China's infrastructure loans and vaccine sharing are part of Beijing's overall geopolitical strategy. Beijing denies that it engages in what is called vaccine diplomacy, leveraging the supply of critical COVID-19 shots to exert political pressure. The State Department says life-saving vaccines must never be used as a tool in that way. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Earth's climate is getting so hot that temperatures in about a decade will probably blow past the level of warming that world leaders have sought to prevent. That's according to a report released Monday that the United Nations calls a, quote, code red for humanity, unquote. Report co-author Linda Mearns of the U.S. National Center for Atmospheric Research says she sees nowhere that will be safe from climate change. But scientists also eased back a bit on the likelihood of the absolute worst climate catastrophes. The report by the Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change makes more precise forecasts for the 21st century than it did last time it was issued in 2013. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Paul Alexander, I am Chinedu Ofoed in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a good evening.